Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of some articles that I have written that you might be interested in and tell you how to access them. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there a tab that says articles. You will discover there some articles that I produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. I'm not a regular blogger, but when things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. We continue our exposition of the book of Revelation. We've come now to Revelation chapter 17, verse 8. I'm backing up. I covered a part of this sequence in the last study, but I feel like to make the transition, I need to back up a little bit and repeat what I said as we move toward the end of the chapter. So we pick up in verse 8. The angel tells John, "The beast which you saw once was, now is not, and yet will come out of the abyss and go to its destruction. The inhabitants of the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world, will be astonished when they see the beast, because it once was, now is not, and yet will come." Here the interpreting angel begins to unpack the symbolism which will give John better light and strike the chord of hope and triumph in suffering saints. But interpretively, even with the angel's help, things get sticky. I said in the last study that I will not bluff or try to tell you that I have answers which I do not possess. That's the main reason I said that I hesitated for so long to attempt an exposition of this book. Every sober interpreter, and not all are sober, I must tell you, acknowledges that right here is where things get the thickest. I will explain what I can. I will leave the rest to a time of better light. The beast in verse 8, we already know, is the Antichrist. Here's the tricky part with respect to the beast, or the Antichrist, however. He once was, now is not, and yet will come up out of the abyss. Scholars and commentaries have been all over the map on this one. I pointed out, as we reviewed, that many have thought this reference was to the Roman Emperor Nero. I'll not go through all of that again. For the sake of time, I will just say that that interpretation has been totally discredited. Nor can the beast here be understood as ancient Rome, contrary to the majority of Revelation interpreters. Why is that? Well, it's pretty simple. Because Rome existed at the time of John's vision, whereas the interpreting angel tells John, at the time of his vision and recording it, that the beast does not exist. So where does that leave us? Well, verse 9 says this calls for wisdom. The seven heads, or the seven hills upon which the woman sits. That sentence, "this calls for wisdom," means spiritual wisdom or insight or discernment that only born-again people possess. It implies, I suggest, that the most obvious interpretation, Rome, is not the correct one. But the language has a fulfillment beyond that and will not be deciphered by any but those who have eyes to see, ears to hear, and hearts to obey, the saints. And perhaps only those believers who are on the scene in the very end times will be in position to decipher. The truth is, we don't know. And we should be, though many are not, careful about over-speculating because we may read something into the book of Revelation that might inadvertently bring the revelation into disrepute by those of us who confuse our misinterpretations with God's representations. It is one thing to say that it could be this or it might be that, but we refrain from claptrap sensationalism that treats the book like a Christian crystal ball or a Christian astrologer. That stuff is reprehensible. Run from it. There is another difficult piece of imagery that is challenging, hard to rightly interpret. I'll do my best with it. The part about the seven heads and the seven hills. We see in the text, the woman sits upon the beast with the seven heads. The seven heads, the interpreting angel says, symbolically stands for seven hills. The woman, the great harlot, or Babylon the Great, is situated upon seven hills. Now, here's the deal. Listen carefully. Mountains is the regular translation of the Greek word orgos, not hills. Hills could be right, but normally it's mountains. A mountain, as you may know, is a frequent biblical symbol for a kingdom, and kings represent kingdoms and vice versa. So why is this translation an important distinction to acknowledge here, whether it's hills or mountains? Well, if you translated hills instead of mountains, that favors the idea that hills has reference to the city of Rome, which, as you may know, famously occupied seven hills. That would in turn suggest that Babylon the great harlot, is to be identified with none other than ancient Rome, the city of John's day. But we saw where that couldn't be, or at least I think so. But if we give Orgos its more normal rendering, mountain, it does not fit, for Rome was not situated on seven mountains. So more likely, the seven mountains are emblems of seven kingdoms or kings. If so, the seven heads may symbolize seven mountains, that is, kingdoms, that will in the end times comprise the godless foundations of Babylon the Great, the mother of all harlots, where she sits like a queen. Naturally, these seven heads, standing for seven kingdoms, are the historical influences that will form the foundations of the godless civilization of the great prostitute. Well, looking in the rearview mirror of human history, what empires might be in sight here? Well, we take our cues from the biblical record, and those idolatrous and immoral and bloodthirsty foundations of Babylon the Great would perhaps be Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. That's six. The seventh would be Babylon the Great, out of which the Antichrist would emerge as the eighth. But folks, that's a theory. But something like that theory appears to be what is in view. They are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other is yet to come. But when he does come, he must remain for only a little while. The interpreting angel explains that those seven heads represent seven mountains or kingdoms. Five of those rulers are deceased. The language, fallen, suggests overthrown at the time of John's writing. One of the seven kings or kingdoms is alive, as John writes. That would be Rome. But it appears that the beast is connected or grows out of those who have preceded him. What is very strange is that the beast appears to be someone who has been previously on the scene, but no longer is. A person who will briefly reemerge from the pit of hell, that is the abyss, as an incarnation of Satan himself, full of all Satan's foulness and wicked fury. We could ask ourselves, now who might that be? But that would be an exercise in futility. We've been told what to look for. Some figure who was, did not exist at the time John wrote, but who will reappear from hell itself, all locked and loaded for unmitigated evil. When the time is upon them, as history takes shape closer and closer to the end, the identity of that person will become clear, so clear that those saints in that generation will have wisdom and will not be deceived by this demonic supernaturalism. And there is the grace of God. However, whoever he is, his time to work Satan's evil purposes will be short before God sends him to his everlasting destruction. The beast who once was, now is not, is an eighth king. He belongs to the seventh and is now going to his destruction. All of this is very difficult. The angel appears to be interpreting Daniel's visions, especially chapter 7 through 8. It seems that the beast or the Antichrist will emerge somehow from the seven rulers, but how is far from clear. Verse 12, the 10 horns you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but who for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast. The 10 horns are also 10 kings, different than the seven. By the political power the Antichrist acquires by virtue of his supernatural ascent from the pit or the abyss, whereby he counterfeits the resurrection of Christ, the beast will have the clout to install 10 puppet kings to rule as his surrogates around the globe. 10 may not be a literal number. It's perhaps a symbolic number big enough to say that the Antichrist will have his political bases well covered to prevent any interference or objection to his global intentions. This speaks of a global takeover conspiracy. The 10 kings are all totally on board with making the beast the supreme ruler of the earth, the counterfeit God. That is their singular mandate, and then get out of the way. Verse 13, they have one purpose, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. As I say, they have a singular mission, to use their power and authority on behalf of the beast to promote his agenda in opposing Christ, the Lamb, and his people. Verse 14, they will wage war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will triumph over them because he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and with him will be his called, chosen, and faithful followers. At the Battle of Armageddon, the beast and all his associates will come together to fight in one manner or another at some site or other, maybe the literal plain of Megiddo, or maybe not, and wage a great battle that will result in the overthrow of the beast and the kingdoms of this world, ushering in the kingdom of God on earth. In verse 15, the interpreting angel continues to explain the imagery. Then the angel said to me, "The waters you saw where the prostitute sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages." The waters by which John saw the great prostitute in verse 1 sitting emblemize the whole variety of humanity then existing on earth, a humanity that has been seduced by the prospect of the harlot's favors and joined with her and with the pocket kings along with the beast to oppose God. In verse 16, "The beast and the 10 horns you saw," said the angel, "will hate the prostitute. They will bring her to ruin and leave her naked. They will eat her flesh and burn her with fire." But oops, the fabric of global unity starts to fray. There's no honor among thieves. The rulers and the ruled will turn on each other, as often happens as jealousies crop up and ambitions collide. God, in his purpose, will see to it that all that happens. But here, the internal dynamics are not revealed to us, just the fact of the outcome. With that hostility against Babylonian civilization from the beast and his council of kings, much like Islamic hostility against Western civilization, they will gladly use it as long as it serves their purposes, but can't wait to kill it. Well, with this development, Babylon the Great will collapse in ruins, helped along by the hatred of the Antichrist and his associates. More about that in the next 2 chapters. The alliance between the prostitute and the beast and the 10 kings allied with him is a fragile and a complicated one. They use her, the harlot, but hate her at the same time. There's no love lost between them, just a quest for the benefit of employing her for their own evil purposes. It's kind of like the relationship between the political far left and this country. They want to ride with the country, but they hate the country. They hate it as it is. They like the land, but that's all. Well, there's no honor between thieves, as it were. This notation evokes that strange psychology often found between partners in illicit sex, hate. In the end, her, Babylon the Great's, accomplices will turn on her, devour her, and bring upon her a consumptive conflagration to her absolute ruin. The beast and his royal associates will, in effect, cannibalize and plunder the harlot and leave that civilization in ashes, all orchestrated in the final analysis by the purposes and power of God. The next chapter is a lament of her citizens over the calamity of Babylon the Great's utter downfall. an unparalleled catastrophe in the history of the world. In the end, the world and all of its elites will turn upon itself and burn to ashes. The world system is self-destructive and consumptive. The things and powers and privileges and attractions of this world do not and will not last. In the end, they will all fall under their own sinful weight. Only those who are in Christ, who are with Christ, will emerge from the devastation fully intact. All of this that we've been describing is in accordance with Satan's plan, but God has his own plan, and his plan will prevail. He knows how to use evil humans and their evil contrivances to work all things together for good. That is exactly what is going on here. Verse 17, "For God has put it into their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to hand over to the beast their royal authority until God's words are fulfilled." Just as I said, the reason these 10 kings are so compliant with the desires of the beast is the invisible orchestration of our God. At times, God will fix, as in the case of Pharaoh, you remember, the hearts of wicked men the way they are morally bent. Just like the branches of the trees may be along a coast or high up in the mountains of Colorado, they are bent the way the wind blows. Eventually, they are fixed in those wind-blown positions. The same thing happens to human beings, fixed in the positions of their moral inclinations. As for the woman, the great prostitute, the angel explains in verse 18 the symbolism. The woman is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. In the scriptures and even by secular historians, great cities are very frequently referred to by singular feminine pronouns, like a ship is referred to as she. This wicked woman, this notorious prostitute, cultural prostitute, who lends her body to the beast, that is, translated, that great world city or civilization whose culture commands by her influence all the great men of the earth. There is a preview of her punishment, the trailer, so to speak. You want to see the film? Next chapter. So what do we learn here from chapter 17 before we move on to 18? Well, consider this. This world system is one big whore who lives in the wilderness, a dry and thirsty land of terrors and perils. For all her attractions, you do not want to get in bed with her. You do not want to sleep with her, lest you wake up in hell with her. Any hope, folks, that this world is going to get better, safer, more secure, more fair, and equitable as a result of any election or any political system is a pipe dream. People all over the world, and especially here in our country, tend to hang on to that kind of thing. We live under the aegis of a philosophy, a hypothesis of evolution, which is not only a biological theory, but also political theory. The idea that things change, and they eventually change for the better, and better, and better. And eventually it'll all work out, and we'll find ways of managing these things. Well, that's not going to happen. The truth is, history is on a collision course with a rendezvous with God. In the end, one day, all of this is going to come together in a great world system that will be the capstone of all world systems. All of the evils, all of the faults, all of the horrors, all the bad things that have existed in the world kingdoms up to this point will all be gathered up in one and magnified in that last great world system. It will seem to get better for those who are lost, one great harmonious world religion under the Antichrist. But even when the day comes under the Antichrist, when the world, the whore, believes that finally all the right pieces are in place, peace and security in our times, when the world believes that politically all has evolved to the point that we'll have all that we've been looking for, it will be a terrible mirage. For us believers, what we can learn from chapter 17 is this. We must not be naive. We must put on our biblical spectacles. Over the long haul, expect things to get worse before, in the end, God makes them vastly better. If you're a believer, resist the temptation to chase the whore. Stop chasing the American dream. Get on board with God's plan. Go all in for Christ. Take up your cross and bear it. Resolve to pay the price, whatever may come. It could be costly, but in the end, it will be worth it all. Also, bear this in mind. It may be trite by now, but it's always true, and we must never forget it. Our God is in charge of history. That's the beautiful thing about the book of Revelation. How do I say it? In the end, we win, and we win big. And in the interim, we have God's help all along the way, and He's in charge all along the way. He's a God who makes rulers. He's a God who breaks rulers. Ultimately, our God calls the shots in history. And in the end, His word will prevail. His plan and power is invincible. And there, friends, is our hope. We may die before the end comes, but we'll be resurrected and we'll participate in all the glory of the coming kingdom of Christ. But if perchance we live up to and through the tribulation, and if we survive it, we will see the glory of God. But if we don't survive it, we still will live and we'll be a part of it because, as I said, we'll be resurrected. Well, that brings us to chapter 18, where we have a great lament over fallen Babylon. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven. He had great authority, and the earth was illuminated by his splendor. And with a mighty voice, he shouted, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling for demons and a haunt for every impure spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird and a haunt for every unclean and detestable animal. For all the nations have drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her, and the merchants of the earth grew rich from her excessive luxuries." Then I heard another voice from heaven say, "Come out of her, my people, so that you may not share in her sins, so that you may not receive any of her plagues, for her sins are piled up to heaven, and God has remembered her crimes." Those who make the world in the moral sense their earthly habitat live in what Hamilton has called the world's red light district. That is to say, they who choose to chase the world's skirt are running after a great whore and all of her idols. That is just the opposite direction of desiring God, pursuing holiness, and seeking to glorify Him. Those who come through this life with all of its trials and temptations, scarred but faithful, beaten up but not beaten down, perplexed but not destroyed, standing tall for Christ, bloodied but unbowed under testing and taunting, they will answer certain questions differently than those who profess to be Christians, but really are worldlings under churchy dress. Be introspective, but answer honestly. What really gives you the greatest pleasure, to please God or please yourself? What best defines your ambition in life? To hear the Lord say, "Well done, you good and faithful servant." What makes you feel successful in life? Is it that you have finished your course of faithfulness to Christ, or finished in the chips? Where do you find your greatest fulfillment? What more than anything else defines you? Answers to those questions will pretty well tell you whether you're chasing the whore or chasing God, whether you're living in the red light district of life, you know, church people or casual Christians, or taking up your cross and following after Jesus, that is, being radical disciples. You may find you need to take a step back and reset and take seriously what Jesus said, "Take up your cross and follow me." In his visions, John next recalls the announcement of the destruction of Babylon the Great. Well, thank you, friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.